Antichrist. And I'm also expecting somebody to ask about Mark of the Beast too, 666. Okay.
I think that's one of the main reasons why we really need to teach up our children for generations to come, to, so they're prepared even when we're gone.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's
as young as possible.
That's what is happening here, right? That's why prophets like Daniel wrote these things down. Because the Jewish custom, it was an oral tradition, and they would tell these stories to their kids. And it was ingrained in them. It was their story. It's who they were. It was ingrained in them, so they knew that. And that's why you have to understand when we read these, and we see this imagery, and we hear about these symbols and all this, sometimes it's foreign to us. But for these people, this original audience, it was not a foreign concept. They were very familiar with the imagery that Daniel and John uses in Revelation. Very familiar. So we're back up on Facebook. All right, so I'm going to start all the way back over at the beginning. People that are joining us on Facebook, sorry, we had some issues. If you have questions, today's question and answer day, we had one question. Sorry you missed it, and the answer was pretty long. But we might get that question later through Facebook. If we do, I'll address it in the comments after service. All right, David.
My question is about King Darius.
Yeah.
To me, reading it, I kind of feel like, in a way, King Darius loved man.
Yeah.
Because, especially the lion's den, you see that he gets up and he just goes straight to the mm-hmm. air and he yells out. And, you know, it just seems like King Darius believed there was a God and believed everything Daniel said. My thing is what was he just like trying to? Was he one of those Christians? I don't want to say Christian, but he was like, show me, prove it, you know, prove it to me there's a God, even though he loved this guy and he was putting him in these, you know, everybody else would die situations. And yet he would go running the next day after saying, get in with the lions, go to the fighting in the furnace, and then I'm right there saying, I'm rooting for you, type situation. Was Darius good? Was he bad?
Okay. So since David's not mic'd up and the people on Facebook might be interested in the question, let me try to summarize it and you tell me if I'm right. So the question is, in its basic element, was King Darius good or bad? And the question is presented because Darius, he ultimately sends Daniel to the lion's den, but at the same time, he runs first thing in the morning. He doesn't sleep all night, then he runs first thing in the morning to check on him. So what's going on here? I can't answer the question either positively or negatively in terms of was Darius good, because I don't know his heart. God does. But the thing with Darius is Darius does get to this point where he acknowledges Daniel's God, right? So at worst, Darius adds Daniel's God to his pantheon of gods because he was he served a lot of gods. So at worst case scenario, he grabs Daniel's God and says, oh, here's one that I didn't know about. I'm going to put him on my shelf too. And I'm going to pay him some reverence, just like I pay the rest of the gods reverence. Best case scenario is, yeah, he comes to this point and he's like, wow, Daniel's God is the God, right? You know, so that's good. The best case scenario. The thing with Darius, it is fascinating. You're right, because you said it seems like Darius loved Daniel. He did. Darius and Daniel were very close. I mean, Daniel served Darius, was faithful to Darius in his service. But the problem is, Darius is the king, right? And when a king makes a decree, according to their custom, he couldn't reverse it. And he gets tricked into doing this. Remember, the story is the wise men, they come and they tell the king, hey, we've all agreed on this, all right? Which means Daniel was included in the wise men. Daniel agreed too. Well, Daniel wasn't in the audience when they made that decision. So they kind of pull the wool over his eyes and he's duped. Then he realizes when they bring Daniel up, hey, look, you made this decree and here Daniel is over here praying. He realizes at that moment that he was tricked. Right, and he wants to, you can tell from the text, he wants to reverse the decree. But at the same time, if he reverses the decree, he breaks their custom, which puts him in a bad position. Now, the fascinating thing is when he talks to Daniel, he's like, hey, look, I'm going to go ahead and throw you in here. Your God will deliver you. Those are the words he says in an affirmative. Your God will deliver you to Daniel. But the prayer that he prays then, or the worry he has, I don't know if he will or not, but I'm going to go first thing in the morning and find out. All right. Now, here's a piece of that story that I didn't tell. But now that we've been through this and we've talked about the beast imagery, right? So the visions and dreams are that the beasts are devouring people. The visions and dreams that Daniel has, the beasts are devouring people. The interesting thing about the story of the lion's den is that Daniel is with the beasts and the beasts are tamed. There's nobody ever picks up on that. But the symbolism is there. Daniel's with the beast, and the beast, they don't hurt the faithful. Now, when the other guys are thrown in, right, the unfaithful are devoured by the beasts. So it's really, Daniel is really using this to help the reader, the ancient reader, get this clear idea that while the beast may be threatening, they won't overtake the faithful. Yeah.
I think we also see an example of that, the superiority of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
And something else too. Can you comment as far as the faithfulness of Daniel to his, that he will not compromise his faith in God?
Yeah, so the question for those on Facebook is, can I comment on Daniel's faithfulness through the circumstances that we've seen? So the whole series, the title of the whole series was called Faithfulness in a Foreign Land. And the premise was Daniel's in this place, exile, where his people have been oppressed. The Babylonians have gone into the Promised Land and they've taken their capital city and they've carried thousands of people out. Daniel is in the first group of people that are carried away. And Daniel is depicted in this book as a very faithful individual because we don't see any negative quality traits that are shown in the book. It's uncharacteristic of the Bible because most of the characters that we follow are flawed. We see their flaws. Daniel, we see his adultery and his unfaithfulness. And even with Saul, from the very beginning, we see with King Saul that he was reluctant to step into the position of king because he didn't trust that God would, you know, provide. So we see this pattern in the Bible of people that are, you know, we call them heroes of the faith, but at the same time, they have negative character traits. Daniel, I'm not saying Daniel didn't have those, but it's not highlighted in the book. The thing about Daniel's faithfulness, and I think this is the one thing that as I processed this and studied through this, this is the thing that I kept coming back to in my mind. Daniel had this ability to live in this culture that was foreign to him, to live in this culture that was suppressing the truth of God, to live in this culture that was trying to erase his identity as a child of God. And he has this ability to know when he can integrate into culture and when he has to draw the line. I mean, we can't deny the fact that he integrated into this Babylonian culture. He did. He served in the royal court. He became a leader of the wise men, right? So there were parts of this culture that he said, hey, I'm going to integrate into here. But then there were times when things come up and he's like, nope, that's where I draw the line, right? And so that speaks to his faithfulness. The fact that he was able to understand where he was, when he could be a part of it, and when he had to withdraw from it, right? And the faithfulness is the part was when he withdraws, he trusts that God will, you know, protect him. And you mentioned, and I'm going to come, I know, Matt, you had your hand up. I'll come right back to you. But you mentioned the idea of the sovereignty of God. I mean, that is the predominant theme through this entire book. It's the sovereignty of God and how God will use evil, right? He uses evil to bring about good results. See, this is an evil act that his people are experiencing in Babylon. And God is using that to prepare them for Messiah, the coming of Jesus. Yeah, Matt. Yeah.
I just wanted to add that how you said that, it made me think of the similarity to like a chaplain in the military and how they know when to address certain things at the right times and when to not.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially in today's military. Right. Yeah. Matter of fact, when I was in seminary, I flirted with the idea. I didn't talk to Barbara about a whole lot about it seriously, but I flirted with the idea of chaplaincy in the military. And that was the sticking point for me. It's like, how do I know when and where to draw the line? And that was tough. So obviously I'm not in the military, and as a chaplain, I'm here. So great questions. You know, keep them coming. See, this is what I like. I like the dialogue. When I look at, you know, the New Testament, I think they were probably gathered in a house and they were reading Paul's letters. And then at the end, they were like, okay, what's the questions you have? And they were all like, I got a burning question. Help me understand that. Yeah, Don.
So the whole title of this series, you know, for me and for me.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said about how Daniel was actually integrated into something that, you know, really wasn't part of it. They weren't following God, they weren't. But he was part of it. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes we get this idea as Christians that we have to separate ourselves
right.
from that. And we always had, you know, if it's not something that we view as you know, following God's doctrine or whatever, that we have to completely kind of abandon it and shun it. And I think you look at Daniel, you look at Jesus and who he hung out with and all this, there's so many examples in the Bible that are the opposite of that mentality. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, so that's a great... those are the tricky questions. I want to know what you think about that. So for the Facebook audience, you know, I'll summarize it so you know the question. You know, the title of the series was Faithfulness in a Foreign Land. And we sometimes as Christians, we have this idea that we have to withdraw and isolate from society. And that seems contradictory to what we see in Daniel. So what do I think about that? I think we live in a place and time in church history where in the American church, our strategy is to retreat and hunker down. And I think that's a bad strategy. I think that we need to take lessons from Daniel because the reality is we are living, you know, we're all Americans, right? And we live in rural Indiana where most of us are red-blooded Americans, right? But the reality is, as followers of Christ, we are citizens of the kingdom of God first. And we're told in the New Testament, this place is not your home. You are foreigners. You are exiles, right? So we are the exiles. We are living in a foreign land. And so we have to figure out what does faithfulness look like being exiled and being foreigners. And it looks like us integrating into those areas of this culture where we can, because God has a purpose in the integration. See, Daniel integrated into this culture and he made a difference. I wasn't going to break this out today, but I'm going to. I was going to save it, but it's too good. I can't. The reason I know Daniel integrated into this culture and impacted this culture, not only because, like David mentioned, you know, the kings are having these, oh, wait, Daniel's God moments, but today's Advent, this is where we prepare our hearts for the coming of Jesus, right? The birth of Jesus. And I'm gonna kind of highlight this in one of the sermons that I do through the Christmas series that we're officially starting next week. Embedded in that story of Jesus' birth are these wise men from the east who come looking for Jesus. They see the star, and they come looking for Jesus. And the question is, like, how do these guys know? Because they're not Jewish. Wise men from the east. Now, hopefully you're thinking, oh, wait, wise men, we've heard that before. Yeah, in the book of Daniel. You know where Babylon is compared to Babylon's to the east. So these wise men from the east most likely were Babylonians, Chaldeans, coming from Babylon to look for this Messiah. And it's probably, I'll say it's possible and plausible that they knew this story of Messiah because Daniel taught it to them. See, because Daniel was chief of the wise men. And as chief, he's training these guys. And he's probably training them and impacting them. Look, here's something you need to know. If you want to be really wise, you need to know that there's a Messiah coming. Right? And this Messiah that's coming to the Jewish people, he's not going to be just the king for the Jews. He's going to be a king for the entire human race. And so you have these wise men showing up. And I'm convinced in my mind that they only knew that it was passed down from wise men generation to generation because Daniel started by impacting the wise men when he was chief of the wise men. See? And that's what integrating into the culture looks like, right? You look for these opportunities to teach people, to impact people, because you never know how far down the line of generations what you started will spark a move of God. It's incredible. Thanks for bringing that up. Keep them coming, man. You guys have paid attention to me. This makes me feel good. You're asking really good questions. Okay. This is the last one you're allowed to have. No, I'm just kidding. I know.
Can you tell me how long a time, and half a time will be, and exactly what day that'll be?
Well, I did. You weren't here that Sunday. Oh no, wait. We didn't address that one, right? We addressed the 77s, the 62 sevens and 77s. We addressed that. That's not the one you're talking about, right? Okay, Daniel 12. Yeah, I avoided that one for a reason, because I don't know.
I mean, what I'm asking is, like, I've been told, and I can't remember off the top of my head, by a poor pastor, when he was taught, the time was like 2,000, something like 1,000. I can't remember now, so it's, I just didn't know maybe you were told something different, or they just kind of avoided that too.
So, let me see here. This is trying to find where it's at in Daniel chapter 12:7. Then the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river lifted his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time, times and half a time, when the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed. I'm going to cheat. I have a footnote. 2 years and a half a year. A year, 2 years, and a half a year. So it'd be 3.5 years. Now, I'm not going to tell you what I think, but I'm going to tell you what some people think. Some people will link this to Revelation for the 7-year tribulation period, and this is half of that 7-year tribulation. So the belief from that is that 3.5 years, the people that are followers of Jesus will be a part of the tribulation for 3.5 years. And then there's a rapture and 3.5 more years that are too terrible for Christians to endure, or they don't have to endure. Very respectable people believe that, right? So that's the thought behind that, that's where that fits into Revelation. And that gets us into views on dispensationalism, like, you know, end time stuff. Is it premillennial, postmillennial, you know, all that stuff? And I've told you all before, I'm a panmillennialist. It'll all pan out in the end. Yeah. You know, I'll be honest with you. I lost my affinity for trying to figure all this, the fine details out. I lost that in seminary because I became more enamored with the Old Testament. I went into seminary with the intention of taking as many New Testament classes as I could, and I actually ended up taking way more Old Testament classes. it's confusing, David. Revelation and end time stuff is confusing. And I think I made the comment that sometimes we get so caught up in just trying to figure it out that we miss the big message. The big message is that God's in control. And that's the message in the book of Daniel. Right, Rudy? That's what you said. God's in control. He's sovereign. But no, I'm sorry, David. I can't answer your question and give you 100%. This is what it means. I don't know. What I tend to, when I look at Daniel, from my perspective, it seems like Daniel takes the numbers literally. Because remember, he's praying about this 70-year period earlier, because we said he was studying the scrolls, and he found that 70 years would be the time of exile in Babylon, right, from Jeremiah. And so he starts doing the math, and he's like, hey, we're getting close to that. And so there's like three different dates where it could be where the 70 years begins. And so I think Daniel's praying like, hey, let's use the earliest date, because if we do, I could get back. I could get out of here. And then this vision is like, hey, Daniel, you know, 70 years, but there's going to be a lot more time because the sin of Israel is not going to be dealt with completely. And they go through that 77s then. And when you do the math with the 77s, the literal day, if you start when the decree in Nehemiah goes out to go back and rebuild the walls and the streets, and you add that with Daniel, where the angel tells Daniel, hey, when the decree goes out, there's going to be 62 sevens and seven sevens, which leaves you short 1 7. By the way, it's only 69 sevens. And you do the math and you do the conversions from the lunar to the solar calendar from the time that decree is given. I can't remember the exact date. I think it's March 5th in the 500s somewhere. But if you do the math and you add the days, it takes you not just to the year, it takes you to the exact day historically that Jesus made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, the only time he publicly proclaimed to be Messiah. So I think that's a literal. I think we can look at that one and say, wow, God was telling people to the exact day when Jesus would come. That's incredible. I mean, I'd settle for just the year, right? If he could just tell me the year, that's good. And Nostradamus can't top that one. All right. Great questions. Keep them coming. I could do this all day long. Barbara's shaking her head. Please don't.
12 hours straight questions.
Yeah. But no, the questions have been great. I have been amazed at the quality of questions that you all are asking. Any questions on Facebook? Anybody on the comments back there? Oh, come on, Facebook audience. Everybody live is showing you up. Ask some questions. I know we got three people on there watching. Oh, four. Hey. Any other burning questions that anybody has? This, yes. I just want you to know I've been dreading your question for a while, because you have a way. You are intelligent and you intimidate me. So I've been waiting for it. That's a compliment, by the way.
No. My question is, are you planning to do this again?
The question and answer? Well, you know, I've had conversations with the elders, and before COVID, we actually started like a brunch, and it was supposed to be a question and answer time. Yeah, I'd love to do question and answer more often.
And then my next question is, will you tell us well in advance?
Yeah, sure. I only gave you a week.
After church, will you discuss this on the way home? As a matter of fact, I don't think we'll get out of the parking lot. Linda said to me, we've got a really good pastor, and I've never had a pastor where I learned so much, and he's given you an assignment in
don't go back to church and ask some dumb questions. So given that instruction, I went home and used my Bible and several other resources because I wanted to come up with a good answer. And this exercise of yours has turned into a Rubik's Cube. By the end of the week, I was more confused. So I'm just going to give you this. There was elements of a historical presence of Daniel versus God's telling us when Daniel was involved with him. And the meaning of Daniel, which is a Hebrew word,
mm-hmm.
which I don't understand, comes from two Hebrew words, which kind of tells you about God's protection of your faith. So I guess my question would be, what's an added way we can use the value of your teaching from Daniel's story? Can the people of God who find themselves trapped in something that looked like, if we can demonstrate Daniel's faith, can we stop the beast?
That's an interesting perspective. So I want to rephrase that one. If we're faithful like Daniel, can we stop the beast? That's not a dumb question. I was told when I was a kid, there's no such thing as a stupid question. But that definitely is not a dumb question. So you've made me think, can our faithfulness stop the beast? And I look to, so what I do when I hear questions like that, I in my mind, I begin immediately the Rolodex of examples that I see in Scripture. And you know, one of the things that came to my mind, there's two things that came to my mind, and I'm going to do it in reverse order. This one didn't come to my mind first. The second thing that came to my mind was Job. When Job goes to Nineveh, right? And the task is Job needs to call Nineveh to repentance. Nineveh was a part of an oppressive regime, empire, just like Babylon. And so if we take my understanding of the beast, we could overlay that Nineveh was the beast, right? And God asked Job to go to Nineveh and call them to repentance, right? And Job is an interesting illustration because he wasn't the most faithful person. He runs, but he eventually goes and does what God asked him. And the people repent, and God's judgment is stayed on Nineveh. So I'm going to answer the question this way. Can we stop the beast? No, I don't think so. I think that's part of God's plan. Can we slow it down? Can we impact the ultimate timing of the end or whatever the beast may be? I think when we look to Jesus' words, you are the salt of the earth. What did Jesus mean when he said that? Well, salt doesn't stop decay, it preserves decay. So I think our faithfulness is a reflection of God's patience with humanity. This is God's depicted as long suffering. Like the term that's used is like long of nose, which means it's related to like an angry snort. His anger is stymied because he's patient. So I think our faithfulness is an indicator and a reflection of how God is patient with humanity and lovingly waiting for them and giving them the opportunity to come back to him. I don't know if that answers your question or not. But that's where, you know, without any time to do some deep digging, that's where I would, that's how I would address that. I mean, ultimately, in the book of Revelation, when you look at that, we don't stop the beast, God does. Our faithfulness might impact the effectiveness of the beast. But God says he will stop the beast. Good question. All right. So I need to wrap this up or everybody's going to start getting hungry. This is your last opportunity to ask a question. Anything on Facebook yet? Nobody's asking any questions? Going once. Going twice. All right. Good. Thank you for the participation. I was kind of worried. I didn't know if we'd have any questions. But I'm very impressed with the questions that were asked, and I think they were all valuable. That challenged me. I hope it helped you think. So now I want to invite Don. He slipped to come up here. He's going to talk about a few minutes about an experience that he had, he and his wife have had, which kind of gives us, he's told me the story of what happened. We were on the phone for an hour, so I asked him just to condense it a little bit. about, I think, an opportunity that reflects how he was in a place and time and he felt like God could use him in that moment. And I wanted to ask him to speak about that because it shows us in real life, what does it look like to be a Daniel? This is a good example of that. And then when Don finishes up, I want to just briefly do kick off Advent with a short meditation video about hope, and we'll take communion together, and that'll be all. So Don, if you want to come on up here, I think you could grab any mic, any microphone, and she'll be able to cue it up back there. Thanks for sharing with us today. It's on.
Hi. For those of you that don't know me, my name's Don Hayslip. My beautiful wife, Karen, sitting there, now red-faced in the white sweater. We live up in Centerville. And one of the things that we like to do is we like to go to reenactments, where like Civil War reenactments or Revolutionary War reenactments. It's just something enjoyable to do. And I went to college at Purdue, and they have a fort there, Fort Weotenon, and they have Feast of the Hunter's Moon. And Karen and I had never gone to that one, so we went. And so, you know, the whole thing to me looks like, you know, we talk about faithfulness in a foreign land. I think part of being faithful is also being obedient. And I found that in my life, some of the biggest blessings, you know, that have come to me is when I was obedient to what I felt the Spirit was calling me to do. And so this was one of those things. We walked in, and there was, when we walked into the entrance, there was a little booth. So if you've not been to any of these, it's sort of like, you know, when they have the thing around the square uptown in Liberty, where they have little booths all the way around and people are selling things. Well, that's what this is on a very large scale. So we went in, and the first one we saw, we looked at, and both of us, for whatever reason, decided that didn't look interesting. We weren't going to go in there, and we went on and spent most of the day eating funky things and just looking around and seeing all the things. It was just, you know, it's just, there's a lot of different stuff that you don't always see. So on the way out, at the end of the day, we were pretty tired. We'd been there all day. It was pretty warm, if I remember right. And so we're on our way out, and I saw this booth, and I didn't even remember at all when we walked in and what we had decided literally together that, nah, let's not go in there. I looked at the booth and I said, well, that looks interesting. Let's go in there. And Karen told me after the day was up and we were driving home, she goes, I really couldn't figure out why you all of a sudden decided you wanted to go into this booth, because we had said we didn't want to go into this one in the beginning, and now all of a sudden you're really interested in wanting to go in there. But we go in, and as we walked in, we had been to one in Ohio, and there is a gentleman, Stephen Cottle's his name, he's down in Kentucky, and he is a descendant of Daniel Boone. So he owns like the Daniel Boone, I don't know, there's a society and all this stuff that he's part of and all this. So, and he's very, very good. And we didn't really even realize when we'd met him the first time, but 2 years earlier, what we learned, you know, through this experience. But we walked in and Karen looked at him and whispered to me, that's Daniel Boone. And I kind of looked at him and recognized who it was. And he looked at us, and I think he saw the recognition in our eyes. And so he started to talk with us. And he asked us, it was odd. He asked us our story. And we talked about how we had both, you know, gone through a divorce and we met, and you know, and there was a gentleman standing behind him that I didn't even notice him at first, but he was standing behind him, and you know, the discussion went towards what God blesses our lives with, and how you know, sometimes when we go through a really dark period, there's times when, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel is God's blessing for us. And so that was, you know, the discussion about Karen and I coming together was part of that blessing, and just being obedient to him. And Stephen, Daniel Boone, looks up at the guy and says, that's what you needed to hear. And then that's when I saw the guy, and he looked very red. He looked like he was about to break down. Well, as it turns out, this gentleman had been to the reenactment. There was one, I guess, 2 weeks earlier that he'd gone to and met this Stephen gentleman. And then when he found out he was going to be in Lafayette at the fort, he went there as well. And so they'd been talking, and it turns out this guy, if you might have heard of it, I did, but I didn't remember a lot about it, but there's a basically a cult. It's over in, it was in Greenville, Ohio, but now they're based out of New Paris, Ohio. And they now own arguably 3/4 of the town of Greenville, or of New Paris. And it's if you've looked into it, it's pretty scary stuff what they do. Well, this guy was part of that cult, and he had left the cult because they basically said, he has 7 children, most of them are adopted, and they said, these 2 children are not allowed to be in our group anymore, and you have to decide whether you want to be in our group or be out with your kids. And the guy said, oh, I'm with my kids. And so then they don't even call them pastors or leaders, they call them apostles. So the apostles of this church then started working on his wife and said, you are not allowed to, you know, be with him. You're not allowed to, you have to divorce him because he's gone to the devil, and you have to divorce him. And so this is what this gentleman was going through at the time. And so Stephen, you know, basically is a very, very strong Christian. I think he's a pastor. He's ordained in some fashion. And so he kind of turned this guy over to us at that point. And, you know, and that's where, you know, I probably, in my past, I might have been very intimidated and been like, whoa, you know, like, not me. You know, I'm not the guy you want to put this person with. But I just, for whatever reason, you know, when we, the obedience of going in there and then just engaging in that and talking with this gentleman. And I remember talking with him and kind of sharing our story and him sharing a little bit of his story. And at that point, and I think Karen felt the same way, I just had this urgency. It was in my heart. I just had this urgency. I had to take this guy out of the tent around the side and pray with him. Karen and I, is like, we have got to pray with this guy, like right now. I've felt the need to pray, but I've never felt this urgency that I had to pray right now. So we drug this guy out of the tent. I said, let's go where it's not so, busy. And we went over there and we prayed with him. And it was just, you could see there was such pain in his face, but with what our conversation was, he was, I think at first when this whole thing was going on, he didn't have a lot of hope for the whole situation. And as we prayed with him and we continued to talk with, we'd had multiple, and like Sean was saying, when he and I got on the phone, it was about an hour. We called this Stephen up and Daniel Boone guy up and had multiple conversations with him. And each one had to be at least an hour on the phone with him because we were talking about God. It was just really exciting. We were talking about this gentleman. And then we were engaging. The guy's name is John. And ultimately, we prayed a lot with him and a lot for him. And I check on him about once a week. How's it going? What's happening? And it's funny. Sometimes, God's plan, our job is to be patient and wait for him to do his work. And in this case, and that's the hardest part, at least for me. I'm sort of a very impatient person. I want now. And this was one of those situations where God was like, okay, you can have it now. I mean, already within probably 3 weeks of our engaging with this man, talking with him, sharing what we, is truly what God wants for us, not what this group twisted it to be. His wife has now left the cult, which at first, I'll be honest, I didn't think that was going to happen. I thought he's going to have to figure out, we're going to have to help him figure out in some way life after, his marriage and all this other stuff. But now, his wife has left the cult. They found a great church down, they live in Greenville, and they have a church now somewhere near Dayton that they go to that they've been to a few times. All their kids are out of it and all of this. And it's just one of those stories where, at first it was pretty intimidating. I didn't see this going this way, but I just knew that all we needed to do was just talk with this man, pray with this man, be God's foot soldiers in this foreign land. Went over there expecting to have a nice day of walking around and eating, elephant ears. And now all of a sudden we're praying with a guy that's going through a really bad situation. And, I would say that it's been a huge blessing for us just to see, just be part of it. Just you look at yourself and you think, God chose me. God chose us in this situation. And, and I'm sure, there are a lot of people in the Bible that felt the same way. It's like, no, Moses, like, no, I'm not your guy. God's like, yes, you're my guy. Well, this was one of those situations. I just, I talked with Sean about it, and I felt like it was just such a neat story that that we were blessed to be part of.
So there you have it. Thanks, Don. Real life example. Sometimes we overcomplicate it. What does it look like to be faithful in a foreign land? It's just as you're engaging in these things with the culture, right? By the way, I'm a Purdue grad too, and I'd been to the Feast of the Hunter's Moon, and it's a celebration of this culture is what it is. And, I enjoyed it, but in that moment, God gave you an opportunity and you stepped into it. That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like, right? Faithfulness in a foreign land. So the whole book of Daniel was hope, pointing to one point in time of hope. It was pointing to Jesus as Messiah. God kept reminding his people through the prophets, things look rough now, but someone's coming. So today's the first day of Advent. It's the day that we celebrate hope. Hope is like, oh, I hope Jesus is going to come. It's more like eager anticipation. We love Christmas at our house, so it's like, I can't remember. We have, five or six countdowns going on now? Five or six countdowns of Christmas. I mean, they're all saying the same thing, but you know, counting down to Christmas. And if one of them's wrong, oh man. But this eager anticipation, that was Daniel, I think the intent of Daniel, to create this eager anticipation. Things are bad now, but something better is coming. You get to the Old Testament, and that's the way it ends. Like, man, things are bad now, but something better is coming. The closest thing I can get to capturing this, like, awaiting with anticipation is, you know, when you plan that vacation, right, and you got it on the calendar, and it's like, man, life is tough right now, but I know in June there's going to be some relief. This is that type of anticipation. This is what Isaiah wrote about in chapter 9. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest. And then if you skip on down to verse 6, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this.